Lines on the Line, this is the commentary.ca. There's a new book out that looks at the 2010 Olympic Games and their preparations. My next guest is its authors, who contend that no longer are the Olympics about athleticism and fair play. Rather, they've become a sleazy cesspool of greed and corruption, along with a wholesale trampling of civil liberties. In Five Ring Circus, Christopher A. Shaw details the history of how Vancouver Whistler won the 2010 Games, who was involved, and their motives. Christopher Shaw is a professor of ophthalmology and visual sciences at the University of British Columbia. He is the spokesperson for 2010 Watch and the Work Less Party. He previously sat on the provincial council of the BC Green Party. The full title of the book is Five Ring Circus, Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games. It is published by New Society and retails for $19.95. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Christopher Shaw. Good morning, Professor Shaw.
Hello, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
In the book, you detail how the bid came about. When did this all start? I mean, we, as Vancouverites, we seem to have tended to forget how long this process has been.
The process really started back in 1997 with something called the Bid Society. And then that was around for a while, and then it managed to get itself dissolved for lack of filing financial papers, which tends to be a history of Olympic organizing committees. And then came up again out of the event horizon as something called the Bid Corporation. And that, I believe it started in 1999 or 2000, and basically ran with the different stages of the bid process with the IOC until they finally succeeded in obtaining the games in Prague in 2003, in July 2003. And then they, in turn, became VANOC, or the Vancouver Organizing Committee for the Olympic Games, which is now the official corporation in charge of delivering the games to Vancouver and Whistler.
Now, who was involved back then in the 90s and so on?
Well, as always, and this is a very typical event for all Olympic cities, that the driving force behind the games is always a collection of developers who see in the Olympics the opportunity to get funded some of the projects they've had on the go for many years. And these are usually projects that they think would benefit largely from a large tranche of public money, and they can't raise it in the private sector. So the idea is, if you bring the Olympic Games in, all of these projects that taxpayers didn't want to touch before, because they were obviously private for the private sector only, now become these sublime vehicles for the city or the region, because you know, you've got the name Olympics and the Olympic Five Rings branded all over them. So, for example, in Vancouver's case, they had been pushing for a new convention center for years, even though the convention center we have is already underutilized, and the idea that you need a bigger one has been demonstrated time and time again to be ludicrous. Pushing for this rapid connecting line between the airport and downtown, and finally to do See the Sky upgrade. And the last two things are essentially real estate projects. And the Olympics, you know, not only imbues them with this kind of magical quality, and that makes them seem sublimely not only doable but rational. And yet these are projects that have been rejected time and time again by taxpayers when the different entities went out to the taxpayers and asked if they wanted to do it. So RAV was rejected two times, at least by the Regional Transportation Authority before it finally passed after some arm twisting. See the Sky Highway, people have been talking about upgrading it for years, but all of a sudden the Olympics, instead of being one of many priorities in the province, then became the absolute essential thing in order to get the games. So again, it's developer-driven at the local level, and of course the IOC, for their perspective, don't care about that stuff. What they do care about is the marketing rights and the television rights especially, which is where they derive their revenue stream. And so the IOC, for example, pays no taxes anywhere on the planet that anyone can determine, and yet walks out the door from each Olympic Games with well over $1 billion.
Was there an overzealousness, perhaps, in getting the games that we weren't thinking of what happened with regards to the area, for example, the Sea to Sky Highway? If we were improving that, what would get lost in the process? Was there no oversight?
There was practically no oversight. Minister Falcon, Kevin Falcon, who's Minister of Transportation, basically rammed the process through when they were considering the different options. And so once they had identified both the government of British Columbia and the organizing committee, the bid corps, once they'd identified these as crucial to winning the bid, then it just became a question of how to do that. And in the case of the Sea to Sky Highway, at least the initial part, which is the area that goes through what used to be called Eagle Ridge Bluffs, decided that he was going to go over the bluffs rather than under them, and I wouldn't even consider the possibility that maybe they didn't even need to do an upgrade in that area. And they proceeded against a fair bit of community opposition to do exactly that. And so there were arrests, and if you drive past the bluffs now, you see this 50-meter-wide gouge in the earth where the bluffs used to be, and which simply just don't exist anymore. So there's lack of transparency, lack of process involved with everything Olympics, because it now becomes this, you know, urgent item that has to be addressed as quickly as possible to get it delivered, you know, on time for the games. So budgets go out the window, transparency goes out the window, accountability goes out the window, public process goes out the window. It forces everything onto the agenda of the Olympics. And Professor Kevin Walmsley, professor at the Olympic Studies Institute at Western University, basically said that. He told the public in Vancouver in 2002 that if you vote for the games, if you vote yes in the plebiscite, and, well, we can come back to the whole notion of what a plebiscite is versus a referendum, if you vote for it, everything in your region gets suborned into the need to bring, you know, the games for the benefit of the IOC and the bid developers.
Do you see that, though, in other cities where the Olympics have been, like Absolutely. Salt Lake City, Turin, or Beijing?
Always. It's like a cookie cutter. It's amazing. One of the things I hadn't done a great deal of research on until I wrote the book was what actually happened in other bid cities. And when you read what happened in other cities, whether it's Atlanta, I mean, there's some kind of minor difference between summer and winter games in some aspects, but the overall approach, who drives the bid and for whose benefit and what exactly happens, how they get the public on side, how they get the media on side, you know, the kind of the manipulations, it's as if somewhere in Lausanne, Switzerland, there's this thing called Bid Book for Dummies, and they hand it out to bidding cities, and it's almost like a cookie cutter. You read some of the plans for example, Salt Lake City or Turin, and you think you're looking at Vancouver's, and if you just change the names and the dates, they would be identical. It's just really overwhelmingly similar, you know, in almost all details. It's stunning. I don't know any other way to say it. There is a cookie cutter that approach that happens here.
Well, why haven't the people here, though, seen that?
Well, you have a massive media establishment that most people, at least most people older than 30, go to for their primary sources of news, and all of them tend to be solidly on side with the bid and do very little reporting of any opposition, let alone any negative aspects that have come, you know, come to into play in past bids in other cities, in past bids and past deliveries of games. And they are remarkably uncritical. And they, you know, they'll do this thing they call media balance. In other words, if they talk to me and they say one negative thing, they'll make sure they put that in context with 10 glowing things, 10 extremely positive things. So they always, whatever message that any opposition tries to deliver, the corporate media will, overbalance it by making sure that, you know, whoever's reading the article or watching the clip knows that, you know, it's 10 times better than the one negative comment. And remember, it's a culture of saturation advertising. You know, we have been sold all of our adult lives the glories and the wonders of the Olympic Games, how they're financially wonderful, how they are socially wonderful, how they're green, and all that sort of stuff, which is, frankly, in all cases, hogwash. And yet, the power of saturation advertising is it makes most people believe this stuff and want to believe it.
So how much are they saying that these games will cost?
Well, the official operating budget put out by VANOC, I think, is, you know, basing after some tweaking with from the original bid core budget, I think it's coming in about $1.6 billion, of which they're claiming that something like, yeah, roughly, I mean, this is a ballpark, roughly $800 million is public money and the rest is private money. What that doesn't take into account is the fact that all the infrastructure is being built with public money, and about 25% of the operating costs are being built with public money. The operating costs are being funded from public money. That means taxpayers at all levels. And what they also don't count, although they did count them in the run-up to the games, in terms of a need to have, in other words, they said the Sea to Sky and the RAV line and the convention center were absolutely essential to get the games. And yet, if you go to their business plan, which incidentally came out 2.5 years late in total violation of IOC rules, if you go to their business plan, they count those same three things not as cost but as legacies. So they want to have it both ways. They want to have these Olympic legacies and not Olympic costs. But if you add those items on, because those are the big-ticket items that make everything so incredibly expensive, plus security, which is the elephant in the room, if you add all those things together, you get a number that's vastly bigger than $1.6 billion. It's much closer to $6 billion. And there's no way on any planet that the games could ever, during their operating the long-range economic benefits, and that the games themselves during the operating period are self-sustainable, or it might even turn a profit when you only count the 17-day period.
How did you get involved with the anti-2010 movement?
Well, didn't get involved with it. I sort of started it. There was, you know, some colleagues and I who were involved in the anti-globalization movement had been looking at the Olympic phenomena that was emerging in Vancouver, and it became fairly clear to us fairly quickly that this was the same sort of multinational corporate beast that we had seen in other incarnations elsewhere, and then began to do some research just as Vancouver got shortlisted. And that led us to start to try and link the Olympic Games as a mega corporation event that utterly changes society for its own benefit into that emerging or at the time ongoing anti-globalization debate. So that was really the motivation, and then it sort of took on a life of its own. And it's been one of those things that I've stayed with through thick and thin ever since.
There's a documentary called Five Ring Circus. Did you have anything to do with that?
I did. The book and the movie originated about the same time, back in the summer of 2005. The book was just a rudimentary idea in my head, but Conrad Schmidt, who was the director of Five Ring Circus, had begun talking about using a documentary as a means to get information out to a much wider audience than I could reach just by talking to people one-on-one. And so he and I started the documentary movie. He and his partner, Chantal Morin, went on to finish it and did a wonderful job of it with contributions of quite a few people. And at about the same time, I pitched the idea of the book to New Society Press. And Conrad and I, long time, in the past, basically at those early meetings, decided we'd call the book and the movie the same thing, because they reinforce each other.
The games will take place regardless. And so, what do you do now? It seems inevitable. Besides this book, what can people do, I guess, to pay attention to what's happening?
Well, sure, the games are likely to come, although there are some caveats to that, and I think there's some interesting opposition that's begun to emerge, particularly in the Native youth community and in the anti-poverty community. That may make it a lot more difficult than the games organizers think, because the games are always political. Let me preface it by saying that. The games are always political. Whether it's Gordon Campbell, using it to pump up his government, or China using it to, welcome themselves to the 21st century as a new superpower, the games are all intensely political. So what they also draw, as we saw with the Tibetan protests against that were meant to highlight the problems in Tibet during the Olympic torch relay, is that those sorts of groups that have issues, and in my belief, very, very legitimate issues, will use the games as a means to educate the wider public about things that they think are of concern. So, first of all, I think there is a lot of merit in continuing to protest the games and using the 3.5 billion television viewers as a way to spread a message and bring pressure on government. So that's number one. Number two, we see ourselves in Vancouver in the opposition as sort of an educational service. When we started, there wasn't much of an organized opposition anywhere, really. And, groups who had been fighting the Olympics in different cities were doing it very much as a isolated little battles against the Olympic machine. And what's happened in Vancouver is that we're starting to put together an anti-Olympic world movement. And the stuff that we have done, whether it's the movie or the book, now serve as starting places for anti-Olympic groups in Norway and elsewhere who want to understand what's going on and have that ready source of information that allows them to get up to speed a lot faster than if they had to do all the research themselves. So we see it as a way of paying forward to future cities and the opposition to future cities so they can actually learn from our experience. They'll see what happened in Vancouver. They can see beyond the rhetoric and the happy speeches and the happy faces that there's a real downside to the games. And if those countries want to go forward and bid on the Olympics and or get them, they have to understand that it's not all happy news. There's some unfortunate news that goes with it. Whether it's cost overruns or destruction of environment or displacement of the poor, these are all things that at least in democratic societies one hopes that would be on the table for citizens of those other countries to consider.
What do you say, though, to the athletes, the people in amateur sport that, I guess, sort of rely on the Olympics for their athleticism?
Well, I certainly admire anyone who level of capability in anything, whether it's sports or intellectual endeavors or literature or art. But I'm not entirely sure why the bill has to fall on the taxpayer. I'm also not sure why, or at least the bulk of the bill, I'm also not sure why this circus has to move every 4 years. I mean, if it were truly about sports, it wouldn't move. If it were truly about sports, you could hold the summer games in Greece where it all started and do that every 4 years. If it were truly about sports, you could have one winter venue, whether it would be Salzburg or Calgary or wherever, and that would be where you go every 4 years. The fact that it doesn't shows that it's a marketing scam. And it's a marketing scam, again, always driven by local real estate developers, because I'll toss in one of the things someone asked me on a different show today. So, well, how come cities line up to bid on these games if they're so awful? And the answer is because most cities are run by the real estate developers. And this is their little bag of riches that they can pull it off. So, kind of lost the thread of where I was going with that. But
one of the other things that I was reading in preparing for this was there's an article in the Georgia Strait about the book,
yeah.
And they talked to Larry Campbell about you.
Yep.
And he had said that you try to pop up whenever something really great happens in the city, that with this book you're trying to revise history to make yourself a hero. What was your response to him?
When I was done laughing, it was pretty funny. I don't know what great things he's referring to that I pop up all the time in opposition to. I'm best known for the anti-Olympic stuff. I don't believe I've had a particular role in other great things that have happened in the city. I wasn't here during Expo, so I certainly didn't pop up then. The anti-Olympic groups that I've been involved in have certainly opposed some of the more egregiously unnecessary developments in the city. But that's a larger question. I don't really know. And it's in terms of me trying to make myself, rewrite history. No, this is in my view the correct history, and it actually puts a little bit of a different interpretation of events that the mainstream media have tried to provide a one-sided approach to. And so this is a more balanced thing because it actually goes into details about who the players are. I mean, who is Jack Poole? I mean, most people out there don't know. The mainstream media have never approached it. So who is Jack Poole? What does he do for a living? Why did he want the games? What has he been involved in before? Those are, I think, are important questions. I don't think in the book I try and make myself look like a hero. I don't think I am a hero. I'm a committed citizen. I have a role to play. And if government was actually providing the oversight and the scrutiny that they had promised, that was never delivered. If their auditor generals at both provincial and federal levels were watching what VanEck does with public money, then I wouldn't have to. But I made a commitment back in 2003 when the games were awarded that I was going to keep watchdogging the process. And I felt duty-bound to carry that commitment forward up through 2010. And that's what I've done. That's all the book is meant to do, is to honor that commitment. I don't think that makes me heroic or non-heroic. It's a duty I've taken on simply because the governments of the day would not.
Well, what is this we always hear this. What is this notion about that these are the greenest games ever? Is that true?
Oh, it's probably the least true of any of their claims, and that's going some. So, for example, let me give you some numbers of what they've actually done. In the course of constructing the Sea to Sky Highway and in basically terraforming a large piece of the Callahan Valley up near Whistler, they've probably cut down somewhere between 40 and 140,000 trees. So that's not very green. They have created, through the infrastructure projects and the various venue developments, plus all the tourists who are going to come with their air miles, they're probably going to put out somewhere in the range of about 3.5 megatons of carbon dioxide, which currently is about 5% of British Columbia's total. So that's hardly green. They've destroyed habitat at Eagle Ridge. They've destroyed habitat in the Callahan. That's not green. And their only claim to greenness is the fact that the buildings that are being constructed for the Athletes Village and elsewhere are going to have some sort of LEED standard that's going to somehow make them acceptable, and they're going to do recycling. And instead of burning the wood from all those cut-down trees, they're actually going to bury it. So they actually have a very funny part of one of their sustainability reports in which they talk about woody debris. Well, that translates into all the slash that's left from all the cut-down trees. So there's nothing green about them at all. But that's not unique, because there's never been a green Olympic Games. And the one in, up till now, the worst, Vancouver is far and away the worst, although it looks like Sochi, Russia in 2014 is going to be even more awful, because they're actually taking part of a World Heritage site out of that protected status so they can develop it.
Is there a website for 2010 Watch?
Yes, there is. It's called 2010watch.org.
2010watch.org. Are you running in the municipal election in November?
I am running for council in support of Betty Krasowitz, who's the Workless Party candidate for mayor. And she is, as you know, the 80-year-old grandmother who spent 3 of the last 10 years in jail for fighting for the environment. And she will run a hard-hitting, fact-based, and I think extremely passionate and knowledgeable campaign that will cause the other parties at least to consider some of the more pressing needs of this city, rather than just arguing about whether all the social problems of the city can be solved by hiring more cops.
Chris, congratulations on this book, and thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
It is a thought-provoking book. It is called Five Ring Circus, Myths and Realities of the Olympic Games, 1995 from New Society, 2010watch.org is the website. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Planta.